They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
First things first, the president was asked this morning whether it was time to kick some butt about BP, and he answered in kind.
I don't sit around just talking to experts because this is a college seminar. We talk to these folks because they potentially had the best answers, so I know who's to kick.
And then he said it's time for heads to roll. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Nixon Peabody LLP, a full-service international law firm offering practical solutions for today's real-world business challenges. More at nixonpeabody.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 8th of June. Glad, as always, to have you here. President Obama has been talking about jobs a lot lately. He doesn't usually comment on individual jobs, but it looks like, along with cursing in public, the oil leak down in the Gulf has the president trying something new. On NBC's Today Show this morning, the president basically said BP CEO Tony Hayward ought to be fired. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith takes a look at why Hayward still does have his job and whether he can hang on to it.
Barack Obama gave BP CEO Tony Hayward a presidential pink slip today.
He wouldn't be working for me after any of those statements.
Columbia Business School professor Bruce Kogut seconds that emotion.
You know, I very rarely say the CEO should be tossed out. I get asked that all the time. But in this case, I'm really hoping this guy's done a very good job.
BP didn't get back to us, but Kogut doesn't think Hayward is going anywhere anytime soon.
There's going to be massive legal suits coming out of this crisis. To fire your CEO does seem to flag that you think you're responsible, possibly even liable.
And Kogut says companies usually don't like to change leadership in the middle of a crisis. But that doesn't mean Hayward shouldn't start updating his resume. Kogut says this is not time to have the U.S. president calling for your head, especially as he's pushing for energy and climate change legislation in Congress. Carola Hoyos is chief energy correspondent for the Financial Times. She says British consumers and investors aren't as critical of Hayward as people in the U.S., but BP's future business hinges on its ability to continue doing business here.
The U.S. is absolutely critical to BP. It is the single most important country for the company. BP has bet bigger than any other company on the U.S. Gulf of Mexico. It holds more leases of undrilled territory in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico than anyone else.
Hoyos says ultimately BP knows it probably can't hold on to a leader that is so vilified by both U.S. politicians and the general public. For the time being, Hoyos says BP may arrange for the American public to see less of Tony Hayward and more of other company executives. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There are phrases like toxic assets and credit default swaps and government bailouts that will always remind us of the financial crisis and the Great Recession. Also, bubble, as in the housing bubble that popped and helped burst the stock market bubble. I do hate to be the bearer of bad news here, but there is some worry about another bubble developing out there in the bond market. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from New York.
Ever since the stock market collapsed back in 2008, investors have been throwing their money into government bonds and the safest corporate bonds. They might not be getting a big return, but at least they're pretty confident they'll get their money back. Well, Bob Froelich with Hartford Mutual Fund says we should call this what it is.
The definition of a bubble is where does all the retail money go? And if you look at the last year where all the retail money went, it all went to the bond funds.
Froelich says the bubble could pop when the Fed does what it'll have to do to stave off inflation. raise interest rates. He says when that happens, today's bonds could lose 30% of their value if they're resold on the secondary market.
When interest rates go up, people will see the next level of bonds coming out. They're paying a higher interest rate, so no one is going to want to buy any of the bonds that are out there because they're out there at a lower rate.
I just have a very hard time considering that a bubble.
Diane Vaza is head of global fixed income research for Standard & Poor's. She says there can't be a bubble in U.S. Treasuries because, she says, they're risk-free. The government is considered the borrower most likely to pay its debts. As for corporate bonds, she says investors know what they're getting into.
As their anxiety has increased during the past month, they've demanded more to invest in these companies. So to the extent that they're being well paid for their risk, that alleviates some of the concern of this bubble.
Or whatever you want to call it. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
There was bad news today for the tax man. The lower house of the Swiss parliament voted down an agreement between the U.S. and the Swiss bank UBS. The deal would have had the bank give up the names of more than 4,000 American account holders who, Uncle Sam says, owe taxes. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports that today's development keeps Switzerland's reputation as a tax haven intact and leaves the U.S. Treasury short billions of dollars.
Nobody really expected things to turn out this way, except maybe the alleged tax evaders. Martin Press is a tax lawyer who does a lot of work with offshore banking cases. He says the account holders have been gambling. The Swiss wouldn't rat them out.
So far, of that group, they are winners, because they have not turned over any names.
Press says the account holders are probably in the clear. It's in Switzerland's interest not to give them up because Switzerland's banking business depends on confidentiality. But if this is good news for the account holders, it's not for UBS. David Spencer's a lawyer who works with the Tax Justice Network. He says the U.S. agreed not to penalize the bank if it turned over the names. Now that deal might be off.
And that litigation against UBS could conceivably continue, in which the penalties could be quite severe, including UBS losing its license to engage in banking in the United States.
The IRS has already collected some of the missing taxes through an amnesty program last year. Michael Knowles, a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania, he says this is about the money, but it's also about sending a message to the banks and the account holders.
It took a number of years, but at the end of the day, UBS gave us the names. So you ought not to do this.
Even if the Swiss parliament finally agrees to let UBS release the names, a referendum could still block the ruling. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a bounce, a small one, but a bounce nonetheless. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The focus of the European financial crisis has shifted from Greece to Spain. So today, Spain had its first austerity budget-induced street protests. Government workers there held a one-day walkout. They're protesting a plan to shrink the budget deficit, a cornerstone of which is a 5% cut in public sector pay. Today's strike wasn't quite as widely supported as the unions probably hoped, but Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from Madrid. There is still time.
With horns blaring and banners fluttering, the protest felt more like a carnival. But the anger was clear. The strikers, most of them government office workers, said they were bearing the brunt of the budget cuts.
They're going to cut our salaries. I mean, you're going to earn less and less for the same time and for the same effort. We think it's unfair.
The public sector workers feel particularly aggrieved because Spain's biggest problem is not public debt, but the gigantic debt load in the private sector, following Europe's biggest construction boom and bust. Professor Pedro Schwartz of San Pablo University.
What you had is too much lending to developers. Most of these developer companies are in fact broke.
As a result, Spanish banks are encumbered with a mountain of bad debt. And, says Schwartz, international investors have been worrying that this may pretty soon wind up on the government's books.
That is one of the laws of nature. When you have too much private debt, in the end, the government picks up the tab.
The striking workers may soon have another bone of contention. The government is under pressure to revive the stagnating economy and tackle unemployment. At 20%, it's the highest in the Eurozone. Tomorrow, the government presents its plan for labour reform, making it easier to fire and then hire workers. The unions say they won't see workers' rights dismantled. They're ready to call a general strike. In Madrid, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
M and McDonald's aren't the most likely of corporate bedfellows, but they made similar news this morning. Both said problems in Europe, specifically the falling euro, which makes what they sell more expensive over there, is going to hit them right in the bottom lines. You roll Europe's debt crisis up with the weak jobs report we had here on Friday, and there is some speculation about a most unwelcome economic possibility, a double-dip recession. To test the theory, we've called economist Brad DeLong at the University of California, Berkeley. It's good to have you with us.
I was very happy to be here, even though I do have a chest cold.
Well, we appreciate you making the effort. So Ben Bernanke said last night he doesn't really think there's going to be a double-dip recession. But I think if you walked out on the street and asked 10 people who walked by, you know, they would say, I'm not feeling so good these days. What's your take?
Well, Ben Bernanke would say he isn't feeling so good these days. If I recall, he also said that the economy wasn't going to be very happy for quite some time to come. I think that Bernanke has his pulse on what's going on and that he's broadly right in terms of what the balance of the probabilities are. Right, I would give you a 20% chance of a nice, rapid recovery, the kind that makes people say it's morning in America, a 20% chance of a double-dip recession, and a 60% chance of the economy bumping along with unemployment probably above 9% and certainly above 8% for quite a while to go, a so-called jobless recovery. Right? That's what's probably on the cards for us.
I had somebody say to me the other day in a conversation, bumping along a muddy bottom in that we can't really see what's coming. We don't really know what's going on.
What's coming is that the economy is going to grow, but not grow fast enough to pull a great many of the unemployed, particularly the long-term unemployed, back into employment anytime very soon.
What about the problems coming out of Europe, though? I mean, for goodness sake, we have to be worried about the Hungarian economy now?
No, we don't have to be worried about the Hungarian economy. The Germans have to be worried about the Hungarian economy. It's only if the Germans and the French and the British bobble the situation and the German and French and British economies get into big trouble that we then have to worry about what's going on in Europe.
Well, how are they doing so far?
They've acted quite responsibly. They've recognized that they're the dominant economic players in Europe, and so that they have a responsibility for trying to keep the entire European economy as healthy as possible.
So to de-quantify it, if I could, would you say you are calm and anticipating not so bad things, or are you a little nervous?
Well, I'm very nervous, but that's because I think a jobless recovery is a bad place to be in. Right? We ought to have the unemployment rate bumping around between 4 and 5% in the United States these days, given the experience level of our workforce and the structure of our economy. To have it stuck up above 9% for any considerable length of time, you know, that's an absolutely horrible place to be.
Brad DeLong, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor, thanks very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, MBAs swear to do right.
The MBA oath is similar to the Hippocratic oath that doctors take, which is first, do no harm.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 123 points today, 1.25%, ended at 99.39, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ gave up 3 points, 1/10 of 1%, finished at 21.70. The S&P 500 rose 11 points, 1.1% closed at 1,062. Crude oil futures rose today on expectations of tighter supply. ExxonMobil cleaned up 3.25%. Offshore drilling companies didn't look quite so healthy. Diamond Offshore Drilling spilled nearly 4% today. The company couldn't comment on reports of a leak near one of its rigs in the Gulf. Transocean, the operator of BP's ill-fated rig, drained away another 5.75%. BP said today it had no plans to change its exploration and production policies for now. The company sliced off another 5.7% in U.S. trading, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at vanguard.com. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Intersolar, the world's largest solar technology fair, kicks off in Munich. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas plans to visit the White House. And it's Donald Duck's birthday. The famous Disney character made his screen debut in 1934. I'm Alex Mayer.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The giant electronics contractor Foxconn held its annual meeting in Hong Kong today. Foxconn builds a great many of the world's best-known gadgets, iPhones and iPads among them. The recent string of suicides at the company's factory in southern China, 10 since the beginning of the year, has raised the pressure on Apple and Foxconn's other clients to do something. Commentator Farhad Manju says customers of Apple and Dell and all the rest ought to do something, too.
The tech industry only works because there are people in this world who are willing to spend 12 hours a day assembling gadgets in return for about $300 a month, less than the retail price of most of those gadgets in the Western world. It's easy to blame Apple, Dell, and other companies for this state of affairs. But would the globe's electronic giants be outsourcing to Foxconn if we customers expressed moral misgivings about how our gadgets are made? The truth is we don't know, because gadget consumers haven't made a peep. It's time we start complaining. Reports from inside Foxconn paint daily life as something out of a dystopian novel. The factories house tens or hundreds of thousands of workers each, with everything that employees need provided by the company store. There is little support for employees who experience social or psychological problems. China Labor Watch, a watchdog group based in New York, recently interviewed 25 workers at Foxconn. "We work faster than the machines," the workers told CLW. "Every shift, we finish 4,000 Dell computers, all while standing up." I'm not proposing that we boycott Apple or any other company over outsourcing. That wouldn't work, because we'd end up boycotting everything. But Apple and other companies have been responsive to shifts in consumer ethics in the past, and they might respond again if we customers let them know how we feel about labor conditions. Next time you visit an Apple store, tell an employee that you care about the workers who made your iPad. Are you an Apple shareholder? Attend the company's annual meeting and ask executives whether their production practices are sustainable over the long term. Or send an email to Steve Jobs. He recently emailed a customer to promise that Apple is looking into working conditions at Foxconn. Let's make sure to hold him to that.
Farhad Manju covers technology for Slate. Take a minute to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. bad as the job market for new graduates is this year, at least it's better than last year. In 2009, MBA students got fewer job offers, lower salaries, and less interest in their expensive and hard-earned degrees. This year may be better, as many MBAs have figured out how to land a job in a tough economy. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports that it's all about cooperation over competition.
A small group of MBA students gather in a classroom at the University of California, San Diego. The meeting is part networking session, part support group. First-year student Bradley Margul explains why he's here.
To hear other students' plans of attacks, as far as networking and just looking for any sort of employment opportunities.
The other students quickly remind Margul that he already has an internship.
Well, but it's non-paid, so I would like to keep my options open.
Spoken like a true business student. Options, leveraging connections, salary negotiations, this is what UCSD's job clubs are designed to provide. Groups of MBA students meet informally to try out pitches on each other and share leads. Margul says the support of classmates means a lot.
I think that's the most helpful part. I mean, because we always ask each other, you know, if they've heard of any opportunities, and everybody's wishing each other luck, kind of rooting for each other.
Yeah, we've seen a little of everything. We have rejoicing all the way down to sometimes tears, but that's what we're here for.
Robin Darman heads up career counseling services for MBA students at UCSD. Darman says last year's meetings were full of desperation and fear because the job market was so bad.
But this year it's been fun because they're still nervous, but they're feisty and they're out there and they're looking for stuff.
A lot of business schools are beefing up their career clubs, like University of Michigan and Columbia. The University of Washington's business school hosts a weekly conference call for current and former students. Counselor Ann Gerard says the calls help students build connections and keep each other on track.
Each person has an opportunity to practice their introduction and talk about what their goals are in terms of doing a job search, as well as to report in progress that they've made during the week or obstacles that they might have encountered.
If this sounds like a humbled MBA grad, it is. Students know that there are fewer jobs out there and that relationships are important. The classmate you help out today may be the one doing the hiring tomorrow. Kip Harrell's president of the MBA Career Services Council.
I also see a lot of our students sharing leads with each other. If they see something that's not quite exactly a fit for them, or even get an offer from a company that may not be right for them.
He says students are getting job offers later than usual and for less pay, but there are some sparks of recovery.
Healthcare, biotech, pharmaceuticals, energy, and especially clean energy.
But that's good.
No, it's great. Yeah.
At UCSD's Absolutely. Job club, second-year student Vince Yuen says if you want the job, you've got to push.
Don't ever think that you're annoying, because people are just so busy that like, they don't remember you unless you're on their case.
I like hearing that one. Yeah. I always feel like I'm annoying.
Sometimes former students return to the job club and fulfill their final obligation, helping their fellow MBAs get off to a good start. In San Diego, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
If you or maybe somebody you've been paying the tuition bills for is in search of work, the career counselors at UCSD School of Management have put together some top websites for jobs and internships. And we've also got some links to some non-MBA job clubs that anybody can join. It's all online at marketplace.org. After two-plus years of a Wall Street-induced financial crisis, though, masters of business administration are under more of a microscope than they used to be, especially the ones that might wind up working in high finance. Before they get to Wall Street, some new business school graduates are signing on to a new professional code of conduct called the MBA Oath. Peter Escher, Harvard Business School class of 09, helped write the MBA Oath and the new book of the same title. Pete, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Last May, when you guys were sitting around up at the Harvard Business School about to graduate into an environment where business professionals and Wall Street was not held in the highest regard, were you driven to this a little bit out of a sense of embarrassment and, oh, man, we have to do something to rehabilitate the reputation here?
Certainly the financial crisis framed the MBA Oath in our mind. You heard terms like MBA standing for mediocre but arrogant. Or
I hadn't heard that, actually.
I think there was, a degree of saying we want this MBA degree to mean something important to us. We thought to ourselves, what would it look like if we created a code of conduct that we wanted to live by as business practitioners?
And basically, what does the version you came up with say?
The MBA oath is similar to the Hippocratic oath that doctors take, which is first, do no harm. The MBA oath speaks to the idea of acting with integrity, following the law, and this idea that to do what's in the best interest of shareholders, you need to take a long-term perspective and balance a lot of different stakeholders, such as your customers, your employees, and even society at large.
Mm-hmm. Picking up again on that idea of the Hippocratic Oath, though, and the oath that doctors take when they graduate, you know, if doctors get something wrong, people get sick, they are grievously injured, or they die. When MBAs and business professionals get something wrong, the effect is attenuated through space, right? I mean, if somebody's house gets foreclosed upon because the bank made a bad mortgage decision, that's sort of at a remove from the person who actually made that decision to issue that mortgage. Do you see my sensibility there?
I think that certainly as a business practitioner operates, he or she may not readily see the responsibility that he or she has to society at large. But if anything has surfaced over the last couple of years in terms of the $50 trillion bailout or assets that were lost, it's that business decisions do matter. They do affect a lot of people.
Now, what about yourself? You've got a job in finance up in Boston someplace, right?
That's right. I work at Liberty Mutual making venture capital and private equity investments.
Living and breathing the MBA oath every day, right?
You know, it's interesting that one of the first things I did was take a look at our company's value statements, and I was impressed. It speaks to the idea of integrity, but specifically through the lens of the customer, that the customer is the most important thing. You know, that's framed next to my computer at my desk.
I'm going to be overtly cynical here and say, you know, I bet if you go to Goldman Sachs and read their mission and value statement, same kind of thing is going to be in there someplace.
Every company has a value statement, and it's words on a page. The challenge for any company and the challenge for the MBA oath is making those words come off the page and making those words influence behavior down the line.
Peter Escher, Harvard Business School MBA, class of 2009, also the author of The MBA Oath. Peter, thanks a lot.
Kai, thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of Cynical Corporate Advertising Strategies. Do me a favor, and the next time you're near a computer, go to Google and do a search on oil spill. You get 942 million hits, takes 0.2 seconds. And the website searchengineland.com points out that right up there at the very top of the list is bp.com/oilspillnews with a tagline that says, learn how BP is helping. BP has apparently bought out all the ad searches on Google, Bing, and Yahoo for phrases like oil spill and oil spill claims. Although it is worth pointing out that lawyers are doing the same thing, buying the ad space for phrases like BP lawsuit as a way to drum up clients. You search Marketplace on Google, you get us. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 123 points, 1.25%. The NASDAQ off 3 points, about 0.1%. The S&P 500 added 11 points, 1.1%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, the IRS wants all those undeclared tips.
Originally, I was declaring 100% until an older server told me I was, you know, essentially being a moron. she told me, you know, you never declare all your tips, especially not all your cash tips.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening
because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.